Martin's point to me that that is a that those are new audience members.
Right.
So that is somewhat additive. And that.
Hi, I'm Brian from Olathe, Kansas, and you're listening to WGXC Akron 90.7 FM.
Calling all radio enthusiasts. Have you ever wanted to be on the radio or learn how to edit audio? Got a great idea for a short segment to play during our drive time shows? Start making radio with us at WGXE 90.7 FM as part of the WGXE Community Contributors Program. No prior experience needed. For more information, contact content@wgxe.org. That is content at wgxe.org.
Do you like a little ukulele? Ukuleles Unleashed is broadcast live from the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill. Carmen Borgia hosts the live segment, and John Sturman spins the finest ukulele music from every nook and cranny of our crazy old earth. So, if you're like me and you like a little ukulele, tune in to Ukuleles Unleashed on WGXC 90.7 FM the third Tuesday of every month from 8 to 10 p.m. or find us later in the archive at WGXC.org. Hear Ukuleles Unleashed Tuesday, March 19th from 8 to 10 p.m.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-eyes into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lee Wijeskoog of Stuyvesant, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Adelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
Rehearsing and nursing apart, we know every card by heart. Overture, curtain lights, this is it, we'll hit the heights, and oh what heights we'll hit. On with the show, this is it.
Thank you. This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm talking today with someone from New York folklore about a very cool concert coming up. So with me is Edgar Betelu, and I'm going to let him talk about the concert. Edgar, welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you very much, Bria. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to tell you about what we are doing.
Okay, and first, you share one of the coolest titles. I've talked with somebody else who has the coolest title of folklorist, but you have folklorist slash. So what is your position at New York Folklore?
Okay, let me begin by telling you a little bit what New York Folklore is, and then I'll tell you what I do specifically for New York Folklore. New York Folklore is a nonprofit organization. Actually, we are celebrating our 80th year this year. We're based in Schenectady, but we are part of a big network of folklorists and folklore organizations throughout the state. Our mandate, our call, what we do is to promote, amplify, research, document, and support in various manners all traditional expressions of the various communities of New York State. We work with foundations, with National the New York State Council for the Arts, National Endowment for the Arts, and different foundations to, as I said, support traditional arts and folk arts throughout the state. My role, specifically in the organization, is field worker, which means that I go around the state, basically up and down the Hudson River and the various counties and the capital region, locating and documenting traditional artists of various communities.
And when you say arts, whenever I stop by the gallery at New York Folklore, which is on J Street in Schenectady, I'm amazed at the variety of arts that are there. So music is the main focus for today to talk about the concert. But right now there's a cool exhibit of giant metallic dream catchers of all different shapes and sizes. You have a small store that has pine needle ornaments and quilting and all sorts of things. So let's get on to the concert. What is this concert coming up?
The concert coming up this Sunday, the 14th at 3 p.m. is part of an ongoing collaboration partnership that we have with WAMC and its theater, the Linda, in Albany. We have been working with the theater for almost 2 years now, presenting traditional folk music from the area, from the capital region and the Hudson Valley. We have presented Indian musicians, Pakistani music. Last month we had a Mexican group performing Jarocho music from the Veracruz area. Next month we will have a traditional Irish folk music ensemble performing there. But specifically, this coming Sunday at 3 p.m., we will be presenting a group called Los Quisqueyanos, which will be performing traditional merengue music from the Dominican Republic, also known as Perico Ripial.
And when you say traditional merengue, can you tell us a little bit about what merengue means and how it's different from other styles?
Merengue is one of the traditional genres of music of the Dominican Republic. The genre itself is an amalgamation of African, European musical traditions that, just like throughout the Caribbean, created different musics in the different parts of the Caribbean. Specifically, in the Dominican Republic, merengue, which is kind of a countryside folk music, and its version more so of traditional merengue. It's a very old form. The instrumentation tells you a lot about, you know, the traditions that contribute to it. On the one hand, you have an accordion which is a two-button accordion, which is exactly the same accordion used in polka, in Irish music, in Norteño music. I mean, it's a, you know, an accordion, the piano of the poor.
I've never heard it called that before. That's very interesting because it does have a keyboard of sorts.
Yes, the accordion is an amazing instrument that is present in so many musical traditions throughout the world. This version of the accordion is actually originally a German accordion that traveled to the Americas via, you know, the conquest of the Americas. Everything came in through the Caribbean, in fact, through mostly Cuba. So the traditional merengue, you have the accordion, you have a double-headed drum, which is called tambora. As a bass, what's used is a marimbula, which is, it's called a marimbula, which is actually a box with metal plates that, when they're played, creates the sound of a bass.
And picture I'm looking at that's on the flyer shows that the gentleman playing the marimbula mm-hmm. is sitting on the box to play it.
Yes, good point. Yes, to play the marimbula or marimba, you sit on the box as you sit on, you know, there are other percussive instruments in throughout the world, like the cajon. So they sit on top of this box, and they produce the sounds that are, you know, the heavy bass sounds that support the group. And then additionally, there is an instrument called the huira, also very, very common in the Caribbean, which is a kind of a metal scrape that is, you know, scraped with a metal, kind of a metal fork. And, you know, it's a rhythmic percussive instrument.
So it looks like it's about 8 to 12 inches long, a tube of metal.
Exactly. That's what the huira is. There are very many, many different versions of huira. Some are made with gourds. Some are metal. And as I said, they're prevalent in many, many musical traditions in the Americas and the Caribbean.
So huira, do I have the word right? Huira is something that has sort of like ridges that you scrape against for percussive sound.
Exactly, for percussive and rhythmic effects. It's a rhythm percussive instrument.
How do you spell huira?
G-U-I-R-A.
G-U-I-R-A, okay, but it's huira.
Huira.
Huira. Okay, and if people wanted more information about this event, and you do from the picture, it looks like it's going to be very cool. Where can they get more information?
Yes, you can go to New York Folklore website, which is, if you type New York Folklore, that will appear, or the website of the Linda. You can look at the event, again, this coming Sunday at 3 p.m.
The website is www.nyfolklore.org. And this is Bria Barthel talking with Edgar Betelu. Thank you so much, Edgar.
Bria, thank you so much for the invitation, the opportunity to be here and tell you about New York Folklore and what we're doing. And I hope to see you there on Sunday. I invite everybody to go. It's amazing music. These are artists that are local. And it's beautiful music. Come ready to dance, so bring comfortable shoes.
Dancing? I'll be there. Thank you again.
Thank you. that treat with a bottle of martini. I'm so sick I couldn't walk or sit. Since then I've not touched it. I won't bore you with tales of being greedy. I'm just into CB. I'm into CB. My family's a weird lot. My stepsister's got a horrible growth. Listens to all this music dick. It smash hits when she's eating a tea. To me it sounds like bad CB. My father's not bad really. He got me these wires and bits. Apart from that he talks to me hardly. I'm just into CB.
Rock and roll music. That's what we're going to use. You say, well, preacher, you play music with a beat. There's nothing but I don't want. I want. I read that and I thought, Mike, the music scene. Well, they were going to do it. And engaging in the sex act. They're asked the question when police dare not step in with the air thick with marijuana smoke. They had one right near Baton Rouge the other day. 100,000 kids were there. The huge speakers that beat out the music as dope-filled entertainers and performers beat up on the guitars and drums in the streets. Those young people that ripped off their clothes and acted like animals. We asked the question, why, by the police? They said, it's the music. It's the music. It gets down in you, it washes over you and beats upon the brain. And I really didn't know what I was doing, they said. I just pulled up my clothes and I had to do it.
When you start to feel the heat,
the new boys and girls that have Beatle records at home, this is the most rotten, dirty, damnable, filthy, putrid filth that this nation of the world has ever seen. To be in your home, you ought to be taken out somewhere and horsewhipped. You hear me? And I mean it, my friend. They're having sex.
Today we are talking to Matt Peterson and Malik Rezamni about their documentary, Spaces of Exception. The film is screening on Tuesday, April 16th at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Central Troy. It'll be followed by a panel discussion about the film. Spaces of Exception juxtaposes the struggles, communities, and spaces of Native American reservations and Palestinian refugee camps. And today we are joined by Matt and Malik to talk about their film. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Malik, can you tell us a little bit more about Spaces of Exception and include why you called it Spaces of Exception?
Spaces of Exception comes out of a longer-term multimedia research project, if you will, called Native and the Refugee. And the purpose of that project was really to try to understand and build connections as much as we could between the experiences and histories and present day realities of Palestinian refugee camps and Native reservations in the United States. And the reason for that is that we saw that there was kind of a broad similarity between the struggles of Palestinians and Native people in terms of the centrality of the question of land And then we also saw a similarity in terms of the spaces, the reservation as this kind of extranational space that is kind of the product of a distinct history of displacement and genocide, but is also the kind of holder of a kind of quasi-sovereignty. We felt that there was a similar kind of dynamic. I grew up myself between the U.S. and Lebanon, so I'm not Palestinian or native, but I was able to observe from the outside a kind of similarity within these spaces, or at least in terms of how they exist within the nation states in which they're located. And so we thought if we could go inside to these places and talk to people, it might be interesting to juxtapose them. And that's essentially what the movie is. It's a series of segments shuttling back and forth between the U.S., West Bank, and Lebanon. The reason it's called Spaces of Exception, in part, is an homage to Giorgio Agamben, who speaks about states of exception. We took this kind of idea of the state of exception, which in Agamben's idea is this period of time, basically, where law is suspended and politics becomes real, which is to say that the full violent apparatus which makes states possible is enacted, law is suspended, but then in doing that, new norms are created. It's time when law and politics fuse. His was primarily concerned with a temporal or a time-based. We wanted to look at it spatially. And we can see that, unfortunately, right now in Gaza, in terms of the complete suspension of any kind of international law and the full brute force of the Israeli state being displayed. And in that, I think, unfortunately, we're going to see the creation of kind of new forms of violence that could be applied even beyond Gaza, right? And it's important to note that Gaza is two-thirds refugees. So Gaza is really a series, for the most part, of large refugee camps. So that's not totally separate from what's going on today there.
Thank you for that, Malik. You mentioned this larger project, the Native and the Refugee. And Matt, I was wondering if you could just explain how Spaces of Exception sort of fit into your broader scope of work.
Yeah, so as part of the Native and the Refugee, we started back in 2014, we started making short films and videos, and we made about a dozen of them. Most of them are available on our website, thenativeandtherefugee.com. But part of that methodology was each time we would visit either a reservation or a refugee camp, we would make basically a short film just from that one trip. And then we would have this material to show as we were continuing to travel and visit different places and communities and kind of have these discussions back and forth about the concept and the ideas. But we also did writings, we've done essays, we put out a book about the Mohawk Warrior Society, and, you know, Roger Jock, who's going to join us at the screening, comes out of that lineage. So that was a kind of deeper dive into the Mohawk experience around Akwesasne, which is one of the reservations we focus on in the film, which is in upstate New York and borders Ontario and Quebec. So it kind of spans the border of the United States and Canada, so-called. So that was kind of one deeper dive into the context of the project. We really wanted to think of it like an interdisciplinary project, you know, a research project. But the film is included in that. We made, you know, this 90-minute feature-length documentary film, which is a more kind of concise encapsulation of a lot of our research and a lot of our visits that can travel around and is, you know, serves as a self-contained event and opening for a discussion. So we're grateful that, you know, it's been screening so much, in particular the last 6 months, because I think people have been wanting to learn more about Palestine in general and the refugee dynamic and the, you know, settler colonial process, but then in the experience of that, wanting to think about colonization in the United States and North America, and what are the kind of resonances between what we're currently seeing in Gaza and what we historically might have experienced or peoples might have experienced in North America. And I think that's what the film hopes to do, or the event on Tuesday hopes to kind of bring to light, is to think about those shared experiences and how do we have contemporary solidarity now with what's happening in Gaza, but then what is the kind of historic solidarity, if you will, or generational solidarity with the lands that, you know, we live on in the United States, thinking about the different violent processes that we know they happened, you know, but we're still learning about what that actually looked like or felt like, or how it was narrated in the media, how it was narrated by the government, etc. And I think the current and the historic, you know, in terms of Gaza and this kind of dynamic of North America is what we like to talk about, and how we can kind of bring that solidarity to life. But then, of course, you know, Native reservations still exist. They're not just this historic phenomenon. They're living communities, struggling communities, still fighting for sovereignty and self-determination. So to think about, you know, how does the solidarity exist in a contemporary way here as well? So, you know, we're grateful that Roger will join us on Tuesday to kind of hear about his work and his experiences. So, yeah, thanks for having the screening.
Yeah, and before the screening, you'll have the opportunity to do a Be the Media workshop, which goes into this idea of diving deeper into long-term media projects from 5 to 6 p.m. So thank you for doing that. And when you view this film, it really puts into context, as someone from the United States, sort of how we have our hand in funding this genocide currently in Gaza as the United States and providing arms and looking back at our colonial history. But you don't hit people over the head with this type of information. You sort of allow people to enter these spaces, these places. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that approach to your collaboration.
Absolutely. Coming off of what Matt was talking about, the idea of it being a multimedia research project, part of the idea of making many of the short films, partially to show them in both spaces and to have it be a kind of cumulative process, but it was also to have, you know, different kinds of genres. So some of the films are more experimental, some of them are more propagandistic, some of them are more journalistic, some of them are more kind of a sensory kind of approach that makes you feel like you're there, and the others are more kind of discursive. But with the feature film, what we were really trying to do was do two things. One is we really were trying to avoid a didactic kind of approach where we're telling you, you know, what to think or believe, but rather we wanted to do two things. On one level, visually, we'll use cinema, sound and vision to kind of reproduce as much as one can what those spaces feel like. And then the other aspect on a discursive level was to see what people's analysis was. So kind of talk to well-organized, thoughtful people working, living, existing in those spaces, what they think both of their situation from the point of view of the camp or the reservation, but as well as the entire struggle, right? The native struggle or the Palestinian struggle. It wasn't so much to teach people about those spaces. It was more like to think through ideas with people in those spaces while reproducing a feeling of what it might mean to feel like physically being there. I think that, and that comes out of the fact that our work in that particular movie was supposed to reflect our actual process, because that's what we literally did. We went there, stayed there, was in that space, and talked to people there.
Excellent. So yes, the screening is on Tuesday, April 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Matt Peterson will be joining us. And Malik Razamni and Matt Peterson, thank you for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
You'll see. car keys, take away my wallet. las ondas viajan de país en país. Y la música es la libertad, la casa de la libertad. La música es el flow de vivir. La radio del infierno, la radio del maldito cielo, sonando entre nosotros en ciudades de hielo, en donde nadie piensa más que en su bloody pellejo. ¿Te gusta a vos? Vuelvo a mi radio con el Beats Costello.
Dish, who has been on our program previously to talk about community radio, is back in the capital region for radio maintenance. Pete recently returned from Puerto Rico, where he had been working on establishing solar power in Vieques, and he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
So for those who don't know who you are, could you explain a little bit about your line of work?
Most of the time, I'm a radio engineer, and I've helped to work on some of the radio work for the Hudson Mohawk radio network, and I usually work on low-power FM radio stations, and I've been an activist involved in helping to create the rules that were associated with these kinds of radio stations.
So your work that you've been doing recently in Vieques wasn't about radio so much, but instead it was about solar power. How did that come about?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Back in the late 80s, when I was going to college, it was when a Gulf War was threatening, the first one back in the early 90s. And I decided at that time that I wanted to get involved in solar power so that we wouldn't have to spend billions of dollars on wars to take oil away from other countries and bring it here. That didn't work out the way I thought it would. So I got into radio instead because I, you know, saw the way that you know, media ownership and control affected whether this country went to war, you know, and so radio was a pretty long detour for me. But in the past 3 or 4 years, I've just been trying to do more work in solar again because I have a project that I'm doing in Alaska with a bunch of, with a radio station called KCAW, Raven Radio in Sitka. And what they wanted was they have one radio station and 7 repeaters in an archipelago of about 300 miles or so. And so it has a lot of area to cover, and it's all on islands. And so the electrical supply is very, very unreliable. And so what they wanted to do was to first of all, fix the radio stations, but second of all, establish them with solar and wind power. And so for the past couple of years, I've just been like studying, trying to catch back up on like all the developments in solar in the past 30 years. And one of the ways I've been doing that has been by spending some time with my friend Lou Yoder in Vieques every year, installing rooftop solar in a big volunteer project that we did. So what happened was after Hurricane Maria, Lou, who grew up in Boston but spent all of his summers with his mom in Puerto Rico, he really wanted to do something after when he heard that people in Puerto Rico were going for 6 months and 9 months and a year without power after that hurricane. And I just happened to come across about 600 solar panels for ridiculously cheap because they were being taken off of a corporation's roof and replaced. it had something to do with sort of tax incentives. Like they figured out that they could throw out the old solar panels and buy new ones and get off on their taxes again. So we ended up with all of these solar panels. And so we raised money to ship a container of them to Puerto Rico. And then we got involved in distributing them and then installing them for people that couldn't install them themselves.
Solar panels need maintenance as well. So in part, how is the project? You're bringing solar panels and you're bringing resources. I know there's a fundraising campaign. Is there also part of training the local residents to maintain those solar panels?
Yeah, that's a really big part of it. And also sort of thinking through how to make it so that, you know, they aren't just another thing that's destroyed in a hurricane. So one of the things that we've really emphasized is like how to put them on, how to also take them back off so you could put them inside during a storm. And there are several people there that we've been working with who've been like kind of training up in the electrical part of it. So it's a real fun project for us because, first of all, a lot of people do have like a little bit of solar there. You know, they might just have like one panel or something, or they might have a bigger system, but things in the humid tropics, they tend to break a lot, so they do take a lot of maintenance. The solar panels themselves are pretty good, but then once you start attaching them to batteries and attaching them to inverters and charge controllers, and there's a lot of wiring, there's a lot of corrosion. So there is a lot to do to keep them running. And so we've been working with a couple of people there who've taken like a real interest in like learning the electrical part and how to troubleshoot them and maintain them.
You know, my wife used to basically, as a Region 2 EPA administrator, was in charge of Puerto Rico for 7 or 8 years. And she actually was hired by the governor of Virgin Islands to help coordinate the response to Hurricane Maria. One of the huge problems was that the federal rules basically say your federal emergency relief has to be spent to rebuild what was destroyed rather than building new things like solar. And the other problem she encountered was even the place she stayed at, they had solar, but it was going back into the grid. And because the grid was down, they weren't able to use it. Has those problems been remedied?
That's a really big issue for us. I mean, there's starting to be more interest in spending money in solar there. But anything that is just grid tied, in our view, is just sort of a waste of time because, you know, if you're in a city like New York City, the grid doesn't go down very much because everything's buried under the streets. But in a rural place, and particularly in a place like Vieques, everything's on power poles. And as soon as a tree falls down on those power lines, the neighborhood is out. And so we really focused a lot on installing batteries and upgrading batteries from lead acid to lithium where we've been able to. Because, you know, it's just like that's a really big leap in the technology in the past, like 10 years is that lithium batteries are, they're still not cheap yet, but they're way cheaper than they were. And they've kind of crossed the line where they're cheaper over the full life of the battery than the old lead acid ones were. So, we focus a lot on systems that, they can be tied to the grid, but they aren't. They don't depend on the grid. They can keep their own power and their own batteries.
How did this experience? What did you hear from local people on how the Puerto Rican history of anti-colonial and anti-military resistance tied in with the energy crisis that they're dealing with?
Yeah, this is a lot of sort of what what motivated us. Lou had been to Vieques while they were fighting the Navy. And just to back up, back in around the early 1940s, the U.S. Navy took over the island of Vieques and they forced everyone to the middle quarter of the island. They took away everybody's land and then they started using it as a target practice so that the pilots would learn how to drop bombs on things. And so every day for decades, like they just, the The island was under bombardment. And it wasn't until about 2003 or so that finally a mass social movement was able to push the Navy off of the island. When the Navy left, rather than giving people back their land, or the descendants of people back their land, because it had already been 40 or 50 years, they turned large part of the island into a wildlife refuge, which sounds good until you realize that that means that they were just trying to avoid having to clean up all the unexploded bombs. And they figured, oh, well, it's okay. If a bird hits the bomb, big deal, you know. So they didn't adequately clean up the island. So a lot of what attracted us to working there was the fact that the people of Vieques have been so screwed over for so long. And we really wanted to do this project. And a lot of the people who benefited from this are actually people who are occupying old Navy land. So it was kind of a squatters movement that took some parts of the island back.
Well, thank you, Petrie. If people want more information, any website they can look at?
Yeah, there's a little bit about it on my website, imarad.io.
Well, thank you very much. Petrie Dish talking about his work in Vieques on helping them with solar power.
Most radio shows don't come with a demonstration, but most radio shows aren't Radio Wonderland.
Greatest hits.
Emotion.